The headlines this hour: Russia dismisses as unacceptable a draft peace deal that Kyiv has presented to Moscow over the conflict in Ukraine. China warns against a potential visit by the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan, saying that the trip will prompt Beijing's strong measures. And a new study finds that Americans' concerns about crime and violence in the U.S. has reached the highest level since the year 2016. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Conflict between Russia and Ukraine is in day 43. Ukrainian officials say with Russian airstrikes now mainly focused on the east, civilians in that region are advised to move out. The government in Kyiv claims Russia's armed forces are currently attempting to surround Ukrainian troops in the eastern region. But the Ukrainian presidential advisor says that everything is under control and that Russian efforts in the east would be in vain. In the meantime, the governor of Kharkiv says civilian areas there have been shelled 48 times over the past 24 hours. Russia says it is not targeting civilians. Elsewhere, the Kremlin has said the drawdown of Russian troops from around Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, is a goodwill gesture for the peace talks to move forward. Russia's foreign minister says that a draft peace deal that Kyiv has presented to Moscow over the conflict in Ukraine is unacceptable. Sergei Lavrov said the draft, introduced on Wednesday, deviated from the proposals that Russia and Ukraine had agreed upon in March. The top Russian diplomat accused Ukraine of undermining the peace talks. He said that Kyiv is not interested in ending the fighting. Lavrov, however, said that Russia will continue the talks and work to secure its own requirements. Moscow says that there has been no rapid progress in the peace negotiations. It accuses the West of trying to derail the talks by focusing on war crimes allegations, which the Kremlin dismisses.
Russia has warned the West against disrupting peace talks with Ukraine. Foreign Minister Lavrov says Russia believes the West is enabling hysteria around the alleged mass killings in the Ukrainian town to derail the peace talks between Moscow and Kyiv. We tend to think that the reason lies in the desire to find a reason to disrupt the ongoing negotiations, and to do it exactly at the moment when, as they say, the light, even if not bright, but nevertheless began to dawn. According to Lavrov, in the course of negotiations with Russia, Kyiv had for the first time put on paper its readiness to declare itself neutral, not aligned to any bloc, and non-nuclear. Lavrov insisted that the Ukrainians had formalized a refusal to deploy the weapons of foreign states on their territory or to conduct exercises there with the participation of a foreign military without the consent of all guarantor states of the future treaty, including Russia. The remarks by the Russian top diplomats highlight the possibility that Ukraine's Western backers may have different motivations or reservations about a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine. For some NATO countries, the war between Ukraine and Russia is preferable to a peace deal.
Well, obviously, Ukraine is being utilized by NATO in a very dangerous experiment, and it's not the first time this has happened. This has really been kind of a century-old project dating back to after the First World War, when there was an attempt to prevent the growth of large major countries like Germany and Russia, so that Central Europe has always been used by, in those days, by the British and these days by the Americans as a wedge against any major country that might become a competitor.
U.S. and NATO are claiming that there are larger issues at stake here, like security for European countries. Because of this, there are limits to how many compromises NATO countries will make to win peace. They say that the result of a peace settlement needs to ensure that NATO members will not be the next target for Russia. The U.S. is also looking at the results of the talks to send a message to China vis-a-vis Taiwan.
There is a long track record of influential foreign policy thinkers who suggested America would benefit from Russia fighting an insurgency in Ukraine. The latest official to express the benefits of Ukrainian insurgency is U.S. Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Colin Kahl. I think with a high degree of certainty that Russia will emerge from Ukraine weaker than it went into the conflict. Militarily weaker, economically weaker, politically and geopolitically weaker, and more isolated.
Unfortunately, the United States is continuing to work, as they did after World War II in Ukraine, against the Soviet Union to ally themselves with extremely right-wing forces who earlier had been associated with the Nazis. And that is a real factor in Ukraine. It's undeniable. And the United States is playing with them as a tool in a game against Russia. It's hard to say what the end game there is.
U.S. officials say they are skeptical that the Ukrainian government's negotiations with Russia will lead to a swift deal. And they are considering how a settlement will impact the security of NATO nations. Some European countries, especially formerly communist ones, are especially nervous about how the conflict will evolve. They believe if Russia feels it has profited from the invasion, it may eventually be inspired to try the same thing against other neighbors.
And so that they use the smaller countries, and Ukraine has been also an example of this, to cause trouble for these other nations. And it seems to me that, of course, there would have never been a conflict between Ukraine and Russia, even after the separation, if Ukraine had been able to maintain its own hegemony away from the influence and the impressions and the pressure coming from the United States and from NATO.
NATO leaders say the Ukrainians are involved in a broader fight on behalf of Europe. Even a Ukrainian vow not to join NATO could be a concern for some neighbors. Therefore, it appears that for some in NATO, it's better for the Ukrainians to keep fighting and dying than to achieve peace. They believe the peace deal would come too early or at too high a cost to Kiev and the rest of Europe. European members themselves do not appear united on how much of a direct threat Russia poses to the alliance. Germany and France are more inclined than their allies in Eastern Europe to feel that Moscow's aims stop at the NATO border. For countries that are closer to the war, there is a belief that they have more at stake.
NATO says its member states have agreed to ramp up the military support to Ukraine.
We agreed that we must further strengthen and sustain our support to Ukraine so that Ukraine prevails in the face of Russia's invasion. We discussed what more we will do, including cybersecurity assistance and providing equipment to help Ukraine protect against chemical and biological threats. And of course, they need different types of weapons. And the allies are providing them with different types of weapons, and we see the impact of these weapons on the battleground every day.
Stoltenberg made the remarks after a meeting of the NATO foreign ministers in Brussels. The U.S.-led military alliance is already supplying Ukraine with advanced arms amid its conflict with Russia. But Kyiv wants more weapons and has been urging NATO to help defeat Russia inside Ukraine to prevent the spillover effects of the war. Russia sternly warns against NATO's plan of further arms supply to Ukraine, saying that it will only add fuel to the fire of the war. UN General Assembly holds an emergency special session and removes Russia from the Human Rights Council. Moscow stands accused of human rights violation and abuses in Ukraine, but it denies the accusation. Speaking at the session, Iran's ambassador to the UN, Majid Takht-e Ravanchi, warned against politicizing the human rights issue.
Iran remains deeply concerned about the continuous deterioration of the humanitarian situation in and around Ukraine, which has sparked significant alarm in the international community. We call for an immediate cessation of hostilities and emphasize the importance of complying with international humanitarian law by all parties. We repeat our call for unimpeded humanitarian access to all areas of the armed conflict in Ukraine. The humanitarian needs of the affected population must be addressed immediately and the delivery of food, medicine, and other essential services to the people in need must be facilitated. The international community should encourage and support continued direct negotiations between Russia and Ukraine until peace is restored. The Islamic Republic of Iran once again calls for de-escalation of tensions in the current conflict and an urgent and lasting solution to this crisis through dialogue. Mr. President, we consider the text of the resolution before the General Assembly contained in Document L3 as politically driven, which undermines the impartiality of our organization. My government attaches great importance to the promotion and protection of human rights. However, we are against the exploitation of UN human rights machinery for political ends, which contravenes the principles of universality, non-selectivity, and objectivity in addressing human rights issues. We have always maintained that human rights should not be undermined by short-sighted political considerations. We stress that the work of the Human Rights Council should be performed in a non-confrontational and non-politicized manner, and membership in this body should not be politicized.
Business experts from Iran and Russia have met in the Russian capital to discuss and review bilateral ties between Tehran and Moscow. The meeting was organized by the Chambers of Commerce of the two countries. Marina Kortanova reports from Moscow.
The West has declared the collapse of the Russian economy as its goal over its offensive in Ukraine. Moscow, however, says the sharp rise in prices of fuel, grain and other goods, as well as record inflation, hit unfriendly countries almost harder. In the meantime, Russia is reorienting its economy to new markets, and Iran is one of them. Level of trade between Russia and Iran hit a new record in 2021, surpassing the equivalent of $4 billion, with Russian exports to Iran accounting for more than $3 billion of that figure, and Russian imports reaching $967.3 million, up to 21.4% more than a year earlier. During a meeting between business circles of the two countries, businessmen and economic experts discussed readiness from both sides to increase their trade level.
Under heavy Western sanctions, Iran seeks opportunities in boosting foreign trade with Russia. The share of mutual trade between the Russian Federation and Iran is insignificant, but our responsible persons have a serious determination to increase this share. Our goal is to increase trade with Russia to at least $10 billion. This is in the short term.
Meanwhile, entrepreneurs from both countries say they are looking for opportunities to enter the market of the opposite countries.
We are very interested in increasing trade with Iran because the Republic of Dagestan and Iran are close, both by the Caspian Sea and the land route. Prices for Iranian goods are also very attractive for us.
As Western countries are increasing their economic pressure on Russia, the country has focused on rapid import substitution and the markets of other countries that have not imposed sanctions on Moscow. Iran has also announced agreements with Russia on the use of national currencies in trade.
Foreign participants know that Russia can use the experience of countries like Iran to foil Western sanctions. They also say boosting economic partnership between Moscow and Iran will help both countries contain Western pressure. Marina Kortanova, Moscow.
China has been rattled by reports about the U.S. House Speaker's potential visit to Taiwan. It has warned of Beijing's, quote, strong measures if such a trip takes place.
The U.S. should abide by the One China policy and the provisions of the three joint communiques. Immediately cancel Nancy Pelosi's plan to visit Taiwan, stop official interactions with Taiwan, and fulfill its commitment of not supporting Taiwan independence forces. If the U.S. insists on having its own way, China will take strong measures in response to defend its national security and integrity. The U.S. will be fully responsible for all the consequences.
A Chinese official warned that Pelosi's visit will severely undermine China's sovereignty and territorial integrity. This after media reports that Pelosi would visit the island in the coming days. China considers Taiwan as an inseparable part of its territory and accuses Washington of pushing the island to seek independence. The U.S. has expanded its military and diplomatic ties with Taipei over the past years, despite Beijing's opposition. On Wednesday, Washington approved the sale of up to $95 million worth of military equipment to boost Taiwan's Patriot missile system. That infuriated China, which warned that it will take active measures against any attempts by external forces to back Taiwanese separatists. Concern over crime and violence in the U.S. has reached its highest level since the year 2016. That is according to latest figures by the independent analytics company Gallup. The data shows that over 50% of Americans worry a great deal about crime. Gallup's figures have placed the issue of crime near the top of the list of national concerns, in par with hunger and homelessness. The data also indicates that crime worry varies by gender, age, location, and even the political party individuals are associated with. Men and Democrats, for instance, worry half as much as women and Republicans. At the same time, the U.S. government's recent national crime data has shown a boost in the homicide rate to the highest level in 25 years. A military base that is home to U.S. troops has come under a rocket attack in Syria's eastern province of Deir al-Zor. Two American soldiers have been injured, according to a U.S. official speaking on the condition of anonymity. There has been no claim of responsibility for the strike. The perimeter of the U.S. base was also hit in a similar incident back in January. Anti-U.S. sentiments are running high in the region over Washington's interference in several countries, both militarily and politically. Syrians have for long been demanding the withdrawal of U.S. forces. Hundreds of American soldiers are currently stationed in northeastern Syria, home to the country's main oil fields. Yemen's former President Abdelrahman Mansour Hadi says that a presidential leadership council has been formed and that his authority and powers have all been transferred to the council. The council will reportedly be in charge of leading ceasefire negotiations with the Yemeni Ansarullah movement. Hadi was absent from the recent consultations that were held in Riyadh by the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, with Yemeni media speculating that the Saudi regime was planning to dismiss him. Some sources had even suggested that Saudi officials had banned Hadi from holding any meetings or giving interviews to the media. Back in 2015, Hadi, a close ally of Riyadh, resigned and fled to Saudi Arabia amid political strife and conflict in Yemen. That prompted the kingdom to intervene militarily to bring him back to power. But the Saudi-led coalition has been facing a stiff resistance from the Yemeni army and Ansarullah fighters for 7 years. The two sides have now agreed to a two-month truce. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight. In United States, the white net being cast by Justice Department prosecutors as they move beyond charging 6th of January rioters could encompass scores of potential witnesses from both inside and outside of government. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Alan Feuer, Luke Broadwater and Maggie Haberman. The piece is titled Justice Department Investigation of 6th of January Confronts Sprawling Cast of Characters. Among the challenges facing the federal grand jury recently empaneled to investigate the 6th of January attack on the Capitol is the sheer number of people who might have information relevant to its inquiry. According to a subpoena issued by the grand jury, prosecutors are asking for records about people who organized or spoke at several pro-Trump rallies after the election. They presumably include two events in Washington in November and December of 2020, that preceded the gathering on the Ellipse near the White House on 6th of January 2021, where President Donald J. Trump told the crowd to descend on the Capitol. The subpoena is also seeking records about anyone who provided security at those events and about those who were deemed to be VIP attendees. Moreover, it requests information about any members of the executive and legislative branches of the government who may have taken part in planning or executing the rallies, or tried to obstruct, influence, impede, or delay the certification of the presidential election. Each of these broad categories could involve dozens of individuals. Taken together, the total number of potential witnesses, or at some point targets, sought after by the grand jury could easily reach into the hundreds. The investigation appears to be in its early stages, and there is no way of knowing at this point where it may go, what crimes it might identify, or who it may ultimately focus on. Many people of interest to investigators might be called only as witnesses. One possible roadmap, at least in terms of who the grand jury may still want to hear from, is the parallel probe by the House Select Committee investigating the Capitol attack, which has already interviewed hundreds of witnesses, including on Tuesday, 5th of April, Ivanka Trump, the former president's daughter and advisor. A relatively small group of political operatives did the bulk of the work in organizing the pro-Trump rallies in Washington that kicked off after the election and sought to challenge the results, often using the slogan, Stop the Steal. Prominent among them, according to interviews and documents, was Amy Kramer, a former Tea Party activist who helped create a group called Women for America First. The group set up a cross-country bus tour gathering Mr. Trump's aggrieved supporters behind the baseless assertions of a stolen election. Within hours of the last polls closing on Election Day, Amy Kramer started working closely with her daughter, Kylie Jane Kramer, to set up one of the first Stop the Steal Facebook pages. Both women were involved, often in close coordination with the White House, in planning pro-Trump rallies on 14th of November and 12th of December 2020, and then in setting up Donald Trump's appearance at the Ellipse on 6th of January 2021. Two other people who helped Amy Kramer were Jennifer Lawrence and Dustin Stockton, both of whom had once worked closely with Steve Bannon, a former top advisor to Donald Trump. Another organizer for Women for America First was Cindy Shafian, who ultimately broke away from the group to form a new organization, the 80% Coalition, which planned its own event on 5th of January 2021. Then there was a separate group of planners around Ali Alexander, a provocateur who rose in right-wing circles after the election. Mr. Alexander, an associate of Donald Trump's longtime advisor, Roger Stone, was part of a group of activists who planned an event at the Capitol itself and marched with the crowd to the building after Donald Trump's speech at the Ellipse. Altogether, scores of people spoke at the rallies in November and December and at the gathering on 5th of January and 6th of January. They included people like Mr. Stone, Donald Trump's former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, and Alex Jones, the conspiracy theorist and host of the television show InfoWars. The speakers also included pastors, state-level politicians, and anti-vaccine activists. It is hard to know who prosecutors might consider a VIP from these events, especially for the November rally, often known as the Million MAGA March, and the one in December, which is sometimes referred to as the Jericho March. There were dozens of VIPs who attended Donald Trump's incendiary speech at the Ellipse on 6th of January 2021, according to leaked documents from event organizers. That rally also featured appearances by Rudolph Giuliani, Donald Trump's personal lawyer, and John Eastman, the law professor who was promoting the idea that Vice President Mike Pence could block congressional certification of the Electoral College results. The attendees at the Ellipse speech included Mike Lindell, the MyPillow chief executive who helped spread Donald Trump's lies about a rigged election, and the YouTube stars known as Diamond and Silk, who are prominent Donald Trump supporters. The federal grand jury subpoena examined by the New York Times seeks information about members of the executive and legislative branches of the government who might have been involved in the effort to delay congressional certification of the election results, suggesting that prosecutors are interested in learning more about the roles that Donald Trump's aides and allies inside the government may have played. It is not clear if any Trump-era executive or legislative branch members have received subpoenas, and there is no public indication that anyone has been targeted for prosecution. But in looking for more information about what was happening at both the White House and on Capitol Hill as Donald Trump sought to stay in power, the House Select Committee has already expressed interest in a range of White House and campaign advisors, as well as contractors who work to set up the rally. They exist in concentric circles in and around Donald Trump's orbit. Among them is Mark Meadows, the White House chief of staff under Donald Trump, who turned over text messages to the House Select Committee that served as a roadmap not just for his own activities, but those of others. He was one of the few people with Donald Trump as the riot at the Capitol took place. Katrina Pearson, a longtime Trump political advisor, was in direct contact with Donald Trump about the details of the rallies on 5th of January and 6th of January 2021, including who would be speaking and what music will be played, according to a former administration official and a House committee. Katrina Pearson attended a meeting in which Donald Trump is said to have discussed wanting the National Guard deployed, anticipating counter-protests. Caroline Wren, a professional fundraiser and a friend of Kimberly Guilfoyle, an advisor to Donald Trump and a girlfriend of Donald Trump Jr., was listed on an attachment for a permit that rally organizers gave the Park Police. Megan Powers, a longtime Donald Trump aide, was listed on a rally permit. Among the Republicans in Congress who worked publicly to keep Donald Trump in power were Representatives Mo Brooks of Alabama, Paul Gosar of Arizona, and Andy Biggs of Arizona, all of whom Ali Alexander, the Stop the Steal organizer, has said helped set the events of 6th of January in motion. We four schemed up of putting maximum pressure on Congress while they were voting, Ali Alexander said in a since-deleted video posted online, so that who we couldn't lobby, we could change the hearts and the minds of Republicans who were in that body, hearing our loud roar from outside. Paul Gossars, chief of staff, has said his office merely promoted Stop the Steal events and was not involved in planning them. Mr. Biggs, who provided a video message for Ali Alexander to play at a 19th of December rally, has denied coordinating event planning with Mr. Alexander. Mo Brooks, who wore body armor on stage on 6th of January 2021 as he told the crowd to start taking down names, also denied coordinating with Mr. Alexander. Mo Brooks recently turned on Donald Trump after the former president rescinded his endorsement in a Senate race and said Donald Trump had repeatedly asked him in recent months to illegally rescind the election, remove President Biden, and force a new special election. Mr. Brooks was one of two members of Congress who spoke at Donald Trump's rally at the Ellipse before the attack on the Capitol. The other was Representative Madison Cawthorn, Republican of North Carolina, who weeks earlier encouraged the public to call members of Congress and lightly threatened them if they did not support Donald Trump's claims of voter fraud. Representative Louis Gohmert, Republican of Texas, unsuccessfully sued Mike Pence over his refusal to interfere in the election certification. Other Republicans who used inflammatory rhetoric around that time included Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia and Lauren Boebert of Colorado, first-term lawmakers who referred to the day as Republicans' 1776 moment. On 21st of December 2020, Donald Trump met with members of the House Freedom Caucus to discuss their plans to challenge Joe Biden's victory. Among those present were Paul Gossar, Mr. Biggs, Mo Brooks, Marjorie Taylor Greene, and Representatives Jim Jordan of Ohio and Scott Perry of Pennsylvania, who were deeply involved in Mr. Trump's efforts to fight the election results. The House Committee has so far asked only three members of Congress for an interview: Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, the Republican leader who engaged in what he called a very heated call with Donald Trump during the riot, Jim Jordan, and Scott Perry. All three men have refused to agree to a voluntary interview.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Dark Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing those who feel the fire burning. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist, whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. He is also a program advisor for the BFI London Film Festival. And Nassim Ahmed, who is a political analyst and writer for Middle East Monitor. Now, Those Who Feel the Fire Burning, directed and written by Morgan Kanibe, is an unconventional, artistic, and powerful documentary about the refugee crisis. The film shows the level of poverty, humiliation, and other afflictions the refugees have to endure as they are stuck in a hopeless situation on the borders of Europe. Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, that was a very emotional documentary. Lee, if I can start with you first. Now, there's been a wave of documentaries about the refugee crisis. What makes this documentary so unique and different?
Well, I think the first question is it even a straight documentary? I mean, definitions are very fluid, but I would term it an essay film, which is a film that kind of blurs the lines between fiction and documentary and is often operating in a kind of very sort of meditative or contemplative tone with a sort of very, you know, focused first-person thing. And what they do in this film with this kind of free-floating, you know, disembodied point of view is...
You're sort of a wandering ghost, aren't you?
You're a ghost, yeah. At the beginning there's a very harrowing shipwreck, and it's as if one of the people who didn't make it from that crossing is now sort of wandering as a sort of spirit around Europe and sort of encountering various, you know, refugees and sort of experiencing a little bit of each of their stories. So in that sense, it's very unconventional, but very striking as a result.
Mm-hmm. And Nassim, if I could go to you next. What was your take on Those Who Feel the Fire Burning?
Well, when I first watched it, and I agree with Lee, I mean, it's very immersive. It really takes you into the life of a refugee and their experiences, but there isn't a grand narrative. Most documentaries, as we know, they have a clear idea as to where they're going, and you get a sense of what the problem is, what the issues are, mm-hmm. and even maybe, you know, recommend some solutions to those problems. That's usually the format of a documentary. But here, you're left with lots of questions, background questions as to where they're from. You know, who are these people? I mean, we know they're refugees, but where are they from? What's their story? Why is this person taking drugs? So it immerses you into their experiences, but leaves me lots and lots of questions about their background and stuff like that.
And that's exactly what I'd like to actually ask you about while you're here, to give some context to this situation. Now, this documentary was made a few years ago, but the refugee crisis is still ongoing. So would you say that this documentary will stay relevant for years to come?
I think the experiences of these refugees will be relevant for a long, long time, because these are shared experiences. These are people who have left their homes, and this is a shared experience throughout the world. Anyone who leaves their homes to a different land, they will face this kind of subjugations, and they will be living on the margins of society. That's how most refugees live. So from an emotional perspective, from this visceral connection which you have with refugees, I think that would stay with you as a form of art for many, many years to come. In terms of providing context and information about the real issues about facing refugees in Europe, I don't think it really touches on those, you know, issues much. Like, for example, 5 million refugees coming from Syria, how that's affecting the socio-political climate within Europe, how that's changing the demography within Europe, and the insecurities it's creating, the political turmoil it's led to. So those kind of questions is not even addressed by the documentary. But in terms of, as I said, as a program which touches on the feelings and the emotions of refugees, I think it will stay with us for a long, long time.
Lee, would you have liked to have seen that, some more political context, some sort of the questions raised while watching this documentary?
It's a tricky one, because on one hand, I really admire the sort of artistry and you know, trying to frame a film about this subject in an entirely different way. It's much more like a sort of Terrence Malick film, you know, with the sort of free-flowing narration. You don't even know who's talking sometimes, or it's not necessarily connected to... Most traditional feature or documentary films about refugees, you follow a small number of protagonists. Mm-hmm. And like you say, there's a clear, we're here, we need to get to here, and this is the goal. And so they follow a very sort of traditional narrative thing. Michael Winterbottom's In This World, or Diego Quimera Diaz's The Golden Dream. You know who these people are, and so it's the film's counting on you to empathise with and then put yourself in the place of those characters. Because this film is doing this much more sort of free-floating, sort of collage-type thing, it maybe loses that direct connection. It's trying to put you in the point of view of someone you don't ever see.
Yes.
And so therefore, that sort of, you know, empathy that we traditionally get in films of, that's our character, how would I react in that situation? It's not trying to do that, so it loses the sort of specifics that Nazima, and you know, where are we? How long have they been there? All of these facts and sort of details are, you know, deliberately omitted, but it's much more after a sort of experiential type thing. Mm. And, you know, there are pros and cons to that approach. I find it very interesting as a film, but if I was studying, you know, if I was trying to understand the refugee crisis in Europe from this film, I'd be left, as Nazim says, with a lot more questions than I had at the beginning.
Well, there's some really great, interesting points that you made. But I have to say, I really love the transitions between places we see. I think it's quite beautiful. And Lee, we see a refugee child there. What kind of conditions do we see them exposed to in this documentary?
Oh, I mean, it's horrific. I mean, it's, you know, and, you know, what it's showing there is what we've seen so many times also in the news, you know, horrendous scenes of children. Because those are, you know, as much as your heart goes out to anybody in those situations, when it's children who obviously have no concept of the wider, you know, implications and ramifications of what's going on, it's horrific. I mean, from what I've read, the UNHCR website talks about, like, over 65 million displaced people, over 22 million refugees, like, right now, and over 50% of those are under 18. So you see the sort of the scale of the tragedy that's affecting everybody, but a very big preponderance of young people, including kids. And it's horrible. I mean, I have a daughter myself. The idea that your young family could be in anything like the situation that we see some of these individuals in is just, it's almost unimaginable. But yet, it's happening right now, you know, countries not very far away from us.
And I think you're right in saying that, and children are bearing the brunt of this crisis. And Nassim, can you shed more light on this? I mean, what other conditions are they exposed to, and what other hardships do they have to endure?
Well, we get a perspective from Dr. Ayman, who was actually going in and out of the refugee camps in Greece. And he was saying, I mean, some basic things like dental health, for example, it's leading to a situation where you have young children who have no access to dental health. So he goes and provides, an NGO which he belongs to goes and provides provisions for dental health, and say 65% of those, we think it's a minor issue, you know, but all of us know what it feels like when your teeth is aching and it's one of the worst pains you can imagine. Mm. And he's saying young children, you know, facing massive dental problems within these refugee camps. But that's just one example of many of the basic health issues which are lacking in those refugee
camps.
There's
also the issue of child exploitation, sex trafficking.
That goes without saying. You know, we have reports after reports which the UN publishes and also EU publishes of child exploitation. And the other day we had a report which showed that refugees on the boats, they were actually forced to jump off, and 50 led to 50 actually dying. So the smugglers, as they were being caught, you know, they forced the refugees to come off the boats. So you hear horrific stories like that, and we see that every single day. But in terms of the real situation on the ground, I think many of them have said that they would rather have not made the trip to Europe and have seen that they're actually stuck in refugee camps with no chance of having any kind of asylum or entry into the country. So
it's interesting that you say that. And Nassim, I want to pick up on a point you made just before we went to the clip about how the refugees thought that going to Europe would be the hardest part, but in fact it's the easiest part. Do you think people would be surprised to know this?
I think even our personal experiences, people I've met as well, they say that once they're here, they expect certain level of, you know, certain conditions, certain living standards, and those expectations are not met. And many of them have been stranded, as I said, in camps, some living on streets, hoping that their, you know, lives will improve. But that's the dreams have not really materialized. It's not really dreams, it's basic expectations which they came to Europe for. So we see that, you know, on the streets as well, refugees trying to make a living cleaning windows. You know, these are people who are struggling, you know, they're not being processed properly by the system. Mm-hmm. So we don't know how many of them will actually get any kind of asylum here in the UK. Many in the Scandinavian countries, as Czech Republic, for example, they're actually paying some of the refugees because of their own personal political situations, the far right, you know, getting more and more support. They are actually paying refugees to leave their countries because of their own political situation. As I said, the far right thriving in support. So refugees themselves, they said, you know, it's much, much harder now, and they would prefer to have actually not made the journey. We hear that from refugees in Syria. Not to mean that they're all facing this kind of situation. Most refugees would still prefer to live here in Europe, trying for asylum, because situations in Syria, in Afghanistan, those war-torn countries which have been bombarded for the last decade or so, they'd rather be in this situation where they at least have an opportunity to find some kind of a better living condition than face the bombs and the barrel bombs in Syria or in Afghanistan or other parts of the world as well.
And Lee, I want to bring you in on here. So we see after that perilous journey a refugee makes, you would think there would be some relief at the end. What was your reaction to this scene?
I mean, I think the entire sort of thesis, if you like, of the film is that these people are in purgatory. So you get this disembodied ghost. And I mean, the That's trailer that you showed at the beginning is like, you know, is this heaven? Is this paradise? And it's like, well, if it's not hell, which it could well be, and you see some of the horrendous situations they're living in, it's certainly this limbo. So they are stuck. They're not, you know, they're not citizens now of any country. They're not being looked after where they are. They can't go back to where they came from. And for me, one of the most nerve-wracking scenes I've seen in any film recently is just after the clip that we showed there, where there's this, the men trying to climb up the huge chains that have moored into the ship to try and get up. And you see this guy going up, and because it's not, you know, Tom Cruise outside an airplane, you know he's safe. But I had no idea if this man was going to make it. And he's very high up. He's really struggling to reach the ship. And it's absolutely nerve-wracking to watch. And you just realize the desperation that you must be, A, to have left your country in the first place, and then still to be trying these very, very sort of risky ways to still, you know, get further away from where you see the danger. So it's really that what it brought it home to me is the desperation and also just the limbo that these people find themselves in. It's heartbreaking.
I think that's a really perfect analogy to describe it as a sense of purgatory, and that the struggle's not over. They're neither here nor there. Lee, you were just talking about purgatory, but death is a very harsh reality that the refugees face almost on a constant basis. What did you feel watching this scene?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because my understanding is that entire sequence is from a short film that Morgan Knibbe made before Those Who Feel the Fire Burning called Shipwreck, and he's literally just put the whole thing in there. And I think there's even clips from a student film he made in Greece. So he's obviously dedicated a huge amount of his time and energy to putting to this issue. And so to put it all together like this, you know, I don't find the film exploitative, but there's one shot, we didn't show it in that clip, but it's from that same sequence where you just see all these Western journalists and people holding up their cameras and looking into it. And I really got a sense of, like, that's kind of us in a way, because, you know, the average citizen of a European country, we see these images, it's so easy to get inured to them and sort of almost numb to what the reality of, you know, the individual stories. And yet we're constantly fed them.
But we're desensitized.
Yeah, it's this weird sort of, not parasitic per se, but it's this weird relationship where we're constantly, you know, people are desperate to get that next shot. You know, some of the horrendous images we've seen of the young boy who drowned at sea, or the young boy sitting in the back of the ambulance covered in sort of soot. I mean, they stay with us, but at the same time it's like, well, is it actually doing anything to make us change our attitude, or, you know, more importantly, the governments of these countries to change their attitude? And that's a really debatable question. I mean, I think the very fact that, you know, a young Dutch filmmaker has spent that amount of time trying to address this issue in a different way is a positive thing. But at the end of the day, you know, it's the change is going to come from, you know, legislation and governments, you know, changing their ideas. And that's, as always, is the big sticking point, I think.
And Nassim, I want to throw that question at you, actually. Does that resonate with you? I mean, what responsibility do journalists, people in the media have when it comes to covering the refugee crisis?
I mean, that very scene, the first question that came to my mind was it seems there's a sense of voyeuristic, you know, the cameras, the lenses pointing at the woman crying. Her suffering, for me, in a sense, if you sit within the broader European context, it just seemed there was a disconnect there, because Europe here, the cameraman and the journalists are using this to actually feed a wider anti-refugee, anti-Islamophobic rhetoric that's taking place in Europe at the moment. So for me, they were not using the word exploitation, but I think it was in a sense being exploitative, not the director per se, but the other journalists, because they were using this to show that we are somehow being taken over by these immigrants, these refugees, and we know refugee has shifted politics, not just here in the UK with the Brexit and also in Europe as well, the rise of the far right, and this is all on the back of the refugee crisis. So those shots, those clips, which we really empathize with, those clips which really give us a sense of what it really feels like to be a refugee and the hardships they face, but they are being exploited to actually show a different narrative to the average person here on the streets in Europe, so that, you know, we are being overrun by refugees, our country is being changed, our culture is being taken over.
Is Europe dealing with the crisis very well?
But what... From a narrative point of view, I don't think it is, because it's showing that somehow, you know, the non-Europeans, Muslims in particular, they're taking over the country, which is statistically, it's just completely wrong. It makes no sense whatsoever. 5% of Europeans are Muslims, which is, if you live for another century, the demography will not change much. But I think the rise of the far right is something that's very real, and it's taking place here, not just in Europe, in America, but it's around the world. You know, you see the rise of the far right, and they're exploiting the refugees as the main, you know, main bandwagon. It's something which they're using to actually push this narrative that we are taken over by Muslims, and which really isn't true. And this kind of movie, hopefully, maybe it might stem the tide of people's emotions and senses as to where, you know, what the real problem is. The problem isn't Muslims coming over. The problem is there's wars in Europe, which Europeans have actually helped in supporting. Like the Britain is still paying money to the Saudis, and also
it's really interesting that provoked that kind of reaction watching this documentary for you. But I suppose the documentary doesn't address that point so much. But final 20 seconds to you, Lee. What message does this documentary leave you feeling?
Well, I mean, ultimately, even though it's doing it in an unconventional way, it is still very much trying to connect you, the viewer, and probably a Western viewer, to the plight of people from other places who are going through incredible suffering. The fact he's doing it in a more overtly artistic and sort of aestheticized way, then it's debatable whether we get to grips with the facts, but as a sort of a piece of filmmaking, you know, I think it's very valid to try that different approach, but it comes with its pros and its cons.
Well, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining the Doc Review sofa. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambayati.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kHz for Southern Africa and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.